I'm very pleased to welcome, in fact, welcome back Brooke Donnell to Fremantle Shipping News. Welcome.
Thank you.
You have your second beautiful looking novel out, Last Best Chance. Sort of got some alliteration in there.
Yeah.
Fantastic cover.
It's good, isn't it?
Captures my attention straight off. These legs that... Who did the cover?
So there's a freelance designer that Fremantle often contracts called Nada Bakovic, and she did the first cover. She did the cover for The Glass House as well. And so she's also, if you line it up against The Glass House, you can see the kind of the same fonts, the thing. So there's these tie-ins, but they stand out really well because that one's got the purple, Last Best, the Glass House has the turquoise kind of, these strong colours, these kind of not full body images. They look really good together as well as apart.
Well, I picked this up and brought it to our meeting today with The Glass House next to it. And I know what you mean about the bold colours. It's not as if they're stark or anything, but they're so clear, and the definition on both of them is tremendous.
Yeah, the saturation or something. I don't know about, but something like that. They're very eye-catching. Yeah.
And I always get excited about how people came up with a title and whether it was workshopped with the editorial board at Fremantle Press for a year or so before you settled it. Did you always have the title?
Yeah, I did. I wouldn't say I always had the title, but I did have the title by the time I sent it to Fremantle Press, and there was never any suggestion of changing the title, which I was very chuffed by because I'm not very good at titles, but it kind of came to me as something that ties the two characters together, and also the climate change aspect of the book, which I'm sure we'll get into, which is this like last best chance to do something.
To do something, and sort of two protagonists in a sense, Rachel and Jess,
yes,
living in different parts of the world, although their first mother tongue is the same.
Yes, yeah.
And you pick it up. I like going to the movies, for example, where I know nothing about the movie.
Uh-huh.
People say, we have to see this movie.
Yeah.
And I might know that, you know, Leonardo is in it or something.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, yeah.
But I just love it. It comes up and I'm thrown around and people next to me are saying, what's going on? And
yeah.
I don't know, but let's wait and see.
Yeah.
And books are the same. I love picking up the book by an author who, you know, that I respect and know and love. And here I've chatted to you about your first book, some while ago.
Yeah.
So I was looking forward to this one. And then I arrive at the very first chapter in the book.
Yeah.
After a dedication for Andrew,
yeah,
we get to Rachel, cycle day 2, bracket CD 2, close brackets.
Yeah.
Now this might immediately mean something to some people, but not to me. And then I read the first, can you read this first paragraph?
I will, yes. Maybe a bit discombobulating paragraph. It wasn't yet 7:30 in the morning when Rachel Mather wriggled out of her underpants and kicked them across the exam room floor. Once they'd skidded safely beneath the chair that held her handbag, she turned so her bum brushed the edge of the gurney, then hoisted herself up. Friction made the protective square of white cotton, like a giant sanitary napkin, rumple, and she yanked the corners to straighten it beneath her buttocks.
Well, I'm just a poor male that is nearly in his mid-70s, and gosh, I've got words like underpants and gurney and square of white cotton and sanitary napkin and buttocks. I thought, my God, what's Brooke up to? She's taken a new lease on life, and she's become Philip Roth in the mid-2020s.
Yeah,
Not quite. So I soon and quickly enough discovered what was happening.
Yes.
Did you sort of set out to take a topic that's in a sense hard to address?
Yeah.
How did you get to this topic?
So I had this. So this novel, I guess, has been kind of gestating for a while. So originally I'd written this novella, which was basically the Rachel character going through this IVF cycle overseas, but not much really happened in it, apart from the fact that in an IVF cycle or a menstrual cycle, it kind of does follow that narrative arc, you know, the exposition, the rising action climax, that kind of thing. But there wasn't much kind of like going on outside it. And then I really liked having this kind of fake setting of this invented Central European country that she goes to. So I
spent some time trying to work out exactly where I was. Yes. I'm looking at these surnames and thinking, oh, I might be in Georgia, or no, I think I'm near Russia, but it wouldn't be there.
And yeah, I wondered that. It is definitely fictional. It's not, you're not meant to kind of be able to guess where it is. And it does take inspiration from lots of different places. So Serbia, Romania, Slovakia, Czech Republic and things like that. And that was, so to kind of get back to your question, so the thing that started the novella in the very first place was when I'd seen online these forums of American women who would go to the Czech Republic for IVF because it was cheaper than American IVF, because American IVF, you know, their healthcare system and all that, so it's very, very expensive.
Didn't know they had one.
Oh, the Americans, yeah. Well, they have one if you've got, you know, $25,000-$30,000 or something like that. And so some people, and still expensive, but they could go to Prague, for example, and have a holiday, in inverted commas, around, because an IVF cycle takes a few weeks, and have some, you know, the medical treatments and things, and then on their day off, they could actually be on holiday. And that really sparked my interest, because I just thought, you know, IVF is alienating enough anyway. You're trying to create a child in this very medicalized, very highly pressured, highly timed kind of situation. And then if you were in a completely different environment where, you know, English is not the first language, just completely different culture, different landscape and stuff, I thought, oh, what would that be like? And so that was the kind of driving force behind the novel, was that whole amping up that sense of alienation, I guess, to like 100, beyond what it's like to just go through IVF.
Yeah, and I get that. I mean, you have to get on a plane, you go off, things are being programmed. But it starts with the whole question of having children.
Yes.
If you're a 40-something woman or a late 30-something woman, and you're worried, to use that awful expression, you've missed the boat.
Oh yes.
And you desperately want to have a child. And I wonder how deeply men think about that. Yes. I mean, I have to say, when I come to the book here, I'm learning about the science of IVF and menstruation and things being done this way and that. And gosh, I think I need to read this more slowly to know what's going on. But I suspect women somehow, through osmosis perhaps, in their own groups of friends and family, know these things and focus much more on these than men ever do.
I don't 100% know what it's like for a man, as you don't 100% know what it's like for a woman, no. As you said before. It is one of those things where once you start talking about it, you know, if you will say to a group of friends, oh, look, actually, we are looking at fertility treatment or whatever, suddenly all the stories will come out. And sometimes it won't be, and often it won't be, that everyone has done it, but everyone seems to know. They'll say, oh, my cousin did that, or, you know, my friend got a donor egg from such and such country, or, you know, my friend's husband had to have some operation in order to have a baby, all this kind of stuff. So it's one of those things that it's surprisingly common, but isn't necessarily, you know, for general kind of conversation, which is fair enough, because it's very, you know, it's very invasive, unpleasant, you know, a bit gory, all those kinds of things. But I do think it can be, from what you hear, and I suppose all of kind of planned procreation is a bit like this, but the men do feel a bit left out in a sense, because it's not, they're kind of just the cheerleaders and standing on the sidelines and stuff. And not that you want, you know, the invasive medical stuff to be happen to you, but I do think that it can become all about the woman, and the men can kind of feel a bit sidelined by it. And
in some ways, I'm thinking that's much closer to Rachel's story and all of this. And then you've got Jess is in this fictional place.
Yeah.
She's gone there, what, in love?
And
things are sort of happening. She thought she'd got to just become a professori, whatever that language is in that place.
Yeah.
About English for people who wanted to improve it. Things go this way and that. And babies.
Yeah.
Come back on the scene.
They do.
In a different sort of way.
Yeah. So Jess is, she's also not from this fictional country. So Rachel goes there to get IVF. Jess is already living there because she's met a boyfriend back in England who's from that country. He says, look, I'm going back to my country. She goes with him. She's in her mid-20s. She's got a lot of ideas about how her life might go, what she might be able to achieve. And after 2 or 3 years of living in this country, she's kind of stagnating, just teaching English to people. I say just, that's from Jess's point of view. She doesn't feel very fulfilled by that. Working as a bartender, just kind of making ends meet and not really
doing what she thought she might have. Making a lot of money.
Not making a lot of money, not making much of a splash, being kind of seen as an other because she is not from this country. And I guess that happens wherever you go, that you can be benignly kind of othered. Because she's not treated badly, but she can't be an insider because she's not from there. And so one of her boyfriend's friends reveals that she's going to donate eggs because it's a great way to get a windfall of cash in a very low income country. She's a student, a couple of the friends are students. And so
Western babies are probably admired.
Yes, well, they're a great way to make money. If you can have the Westerners come over and inject cash into the economy. And depending on, your personal beliefs, if you believe that your eggs are like donating plasma, donating blood or whatever, it can be a good way of making a lot of money for, relatively little effort considering what she usually has to scrape together to make money. And so Jess, being in her mid-20s, she kind of says, oh, people are maybe starting to have babies back home in England, but it's not on her radar. She didn't think it was on her friends' radars. She's got no idea of what this incorporates. So unlike Rachel, who's become this kind of IVF pro after a few years of trying to have a baby by herself, Jess kind of, and Jess kind of goes into it blindly and very kind of confidently, as she seems to go into a lot of things, I would say, and kind of wants to advocate for her friend and find out what's going on. And through the course of that, she does end up meeting Rachel through the course of the novel.
And you guys are going to have to read and find out what happens. But
yes.
But there's also this sort of this other big world going on.
Yeah.
You could be in any middle European country. There's a big expo.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, where did the expo come from?
The expo is a green energy kind of climate change addressing expo. And that came from when I was developing the novella into a novel, and so I introduced the Jess character because I wanted to have that balance of one character who's single and wants to have a baby, and the other character who's partnered and does not want to have a baby and doesn't understand why you'd want one. And I was kind of thinking of ideas of things like, I had heard, for example, that one of the best things you can do to contribute to the fight against climate change is to not have children, because every child is a carbon producing machine, just like we are. So when I was thinking of, if we're kind of seeing the climate and conditions, economic conditions, climate conditions, social conditions kind of slowly going downhill, and a lot of people as they're at that point going, oh, will I have children or not? And that kind of, not that that always makes the decision for them, but it's something people
consider.
It's
a moral stance thing for many people.
Yeah, lots of
world populations hit 8 billion. Someone told me it could never go over about 6.
Yeah.
20, 30 years ago. It's well and truly gone through that a few times.
Yeah, yeah. And so, the more mouths to feed, the more
cars to drive.
Cars to drive.
Food that
produce.
Gets, forests that get knocked down in the Amazon.
Yeah. Yeah.
You name it.
Yeah. So if you kind of think of it, if that angle kind of, because I don't think that kind of thing always, people still have babies and we still need babies to be born because we need the baby to be born who's going to fix all of this, And so that was when I started thinking of that kind of moral dilemma. And I thought, instead of it simmering away in the background, I thought, how could that kind of come to the fore during this 3 or 4 weeks of Rachel's time in the country and IVF? Mm. And so hitting on this kind of, it's almost like an old school expo. It's like, because those expos used to be like the World's Fair and,
yeah,
you know. And
I think Eiffel Tower.
Yeah, Eiffel Tower. Is it maybe that St. Louis Arch, maybe those kinds
yes.
of things? All the newfangled technology.
Yep, you have to come up with something.
Yeah. And so I thought that was what could, because I did originally think, oh, maybe a conference on, like a political conference, you know, like COP8 or G7 or whatever. And I thought that's a bit grim.
Yeah.
I'd like them to kind of have this, I guess, a little bit of hope that in that kind of last best chance angle, they're kind of thinking that what can we do to fight this and kind of get some positivity.
Which enables you to introduce some other characters.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. So Jess's partner, who is from this country and he's a bit older than her, and he's quite, you know, suave European man, very charming. He's a bit of a fixer in the background, has his finger in a lot of different pies, and so he's involved in this expo. And one of the things he's involved in is negotiating with a reclusive billionaire, who this time is a woman. There's a lot of billionaire men, so I thought, how about have a billionaire woman? And so this woman's name's Cassandra Caspi, and she's not been seen in public for several years.
I love that bit. Not only that, but she's coming from New Zealand.
She's coming, yes, I thought, you know, New Zealanders can be billionaires too, you know.
Well, a few have transplanted themselves to New Zealand from other places, having made their millions.
Yes, and there is also, this isn't really part of the novel, but you do hear that a lot of billionaires are buying up land in New Zealand in this kind of climate change, kind of hedging their bets.
Preppers,
way.
I think they're called.
Yeah, preppers and things. So anyway, so Cassandra hasn't been seen in public for a few years. There's all these rumours going on about why she's kind of retreated from the public stage. But there's kind of these big rumours and big energy around this expo, because the rumour is that she's going to be there. She's going to show her face for the first time in a while, and Victor may have access to her because of his negotiations.
The maker of Bitcoin or whatever.
Yeah. I think she's a solar panel battery billionaire.
It's a novel idea, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I'm sure she's coming up with, you know, solar panel driven servers to do Bitcoin or something like that, because that's another climate, you know.
Doesn't happen to have a number of children by a number of different men, does she?
She does not, but one of the rumours going on with her is that she's had triplets. And so that's why she's, you know, retreated from the public eye. You'll have to read the book to find out what's going on with her.
You will. Mm. So there's lots of things happening. You start out thinking, oh, well, this is my IVF, and am I a male mortal going to survive these medical scenes, and, you know, pairs of underwear can be kicked under the chair and everything else. But it moves along at a lovely place. And the glass house did too.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed the glass house, and people should go back and read it if they haven't. Because you've in each case, it seems to me, you've happened upon, you've selected, you've chosen, you've fallen into whatever the appropriate verb is. some issues that are, I suppose you could say they're social issues, but they're issues of our time.
Yes.
People getting old.
Yeah.
In the glass house. I'm starting to relate to that. You know, where do you live? How do you live? And all of those things. Do your kids worry about you? Do you worry about your kids? How do you get on?
Yeah.
And here, this sort of almost quintessential late 20th century, early 21st century question about the world's population, about going green, and about having children.
Yeah.
And it becomes very, very deeply personal.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Is there, are you driven with a message you want people to take?
I don't think so, because I think if you read both of the novels, actually, I don't think that by the end there's too much of a kind of coming down on a certain argument. I'm a very non-committal person kind of thing, conflict avoidant, that might be coming out in there. But I like, exploring the issue and kind of the people angle of, you know, you can think about these things in the abstract: climate change, children, aging, property, you know, should old people be living in properties that could house young families and things like that. But they really don't connect unless you have characters facing those issues and kind of being affected by them and making their own decisions based on their own character construction and what's going on in their worlds. And that's how it happens for us in real life as well. And I think oftentimes we don't... I know it is a novel thing, and I can see why people like it, to have kind of a more climactic kind of approach or life-changing kind of thing. But I personally am more... I really like reading realism, and I like it when it's that kind of like really kind of, you know, real, like without the... Real realism, you know, but without the kind of, you know, climaxes and direct confrontations and things like that. I think a lot of the way we face these issues in our day-to-day lives is often in a more quiet way, a more considered way, and that's what I try to represent. But yeah, no, I'm not, no hidden messages, no making statements, no.
Well,
yeah.
I wondered what was going to happen with Rachel.
Yeah.
And got to the very end and talk about a climactic, anticlimactic end.
Yeah.
Maybe that's realism.
Yes.
We can't say anything. But
no,
gosh.
We don't want to give it away. But I will say that anyone who's done IVF or really been invested in, you know, have I got pregnant in these last couple of weeks or something, who's really on top of it, I really think that they will understand where Rachel's coming from at the end. I think people, you know, maybe men and things like that, or people who didn't go about having children that way, might find it a little bit strange, but it is it should be reflecting reality. That's what I was going for.
Well, Brooke, I really love what you've done in these two books, as I've just indicated.
Thank
where you.
You
take these topics and even me can read it and relate to this and that and learn as I go through.
That's great.
No one wants to think their books are written for a particular audience, particular demographic, particular gender. And I don't think this is. After the first paragraph, I settled in.
Yeah.
I got into the saddle and I and off we went.
Yeah.
Did you think you were writing it for anybody in particular when you wrote it, any demographic? Do you think you're writing it for you? And
yeah, I think so. I think because with writing, you know, you can... There are techniques and skills that you learn and you make your writing better and you develop ways of working out your ideas and forming a novel and things like that. But often, whether someone likes a book or not, a lot of it will come down to taste. You know, did they get something out of it? Was it the kind of thing they like? Did it meet them at a moment when they were reading it? Or did it just not work for them for whatever nebulous reason? And so really often you kind of have to come back to, well, I don't know who else is going to like this. So the only person who I know who I can please and who I know who they like is myself, I guess. And that's what I've kind of come down to with my writing is, you know, if you're going to be writing it for months, you've got to enjoy it as well. But I am pleased to know that people of different ages and genders and things can get something out of it, because it is quite that kind of the medical parts and the kind of personal parts could be a bit kind of difficult to access if you don't have a body like that or have concerns like them, I guess. So
I always fancied the idea of being a travel writer so I could have all these tax deductible trips around the world, because you have to go to the old town to investigate it closely so you can write about it accurately and so on. But here you must have had to sort of brush up in a whole lot of areas to get it accurate, because you don't want some gynecologist reading it and saying, oh, what's going on here?
Well, I have done IVF myself, so I could say Knew what it's like from a patient point of view. I don't really know the, you know, the back end stuff, so to speak. I don't know if that's a silly double entendre. But yeah, so that was from that experience, you know, the kinds of things they say and how the treatment unfolds. And in terms of when you said the travel writing in the old town, I did, when I started the book, it was based on places, like I said, like Serbia and things like that. But I did actually use some of my prize money from winning the Fogarty to do a quick trip over in kind of Central Eastern Europe to see the kind of places where it was set and think about what are the landscapes, what do they tend to be like?
Yeah.
Yeah, what do people tend to be like? And that was definitely a perk of being a, you know, being a writer and being able to say, oh, I really need to investigate, you know, the south of France or something.
I got lost in the old town.
Oh, good.
And I'm thinking, how old is it? You know, it's about 400 years old. I was back here in Freer thinking, no, not even 200.
Yeah.
And yes, it was interesting. And I was thinking, have I been to this old town?
Yeah.
But that adds a nice dimension. But presumably as well, there's a, like a football coach gets appointed to a new AFL team, they bring their own coaching group with them. You know, they've got their trusted people around them.
Yeah.
It must be the same for writers too. You must be able to, with confidence, throw things out and show first readers things you've written.
Yeah. With this one, when it was in a novella version, I had shown it to fellow writers, I think specifically Laurie Steed, who's a local writer, who I think a lot of writers are listening to this, a lot of them will say, oh yes, you know, Laurie's a great mentor and stuff. I got particular, with the final version of the novel when it went to Fremantle Press, I had this amazing meeting with Georgia, who's the editor of...
Georgia Richter.
Georgia Richter, yes, the editor of my two books, and also Rachel Hansen, who's an editor there as well. And we had this really in-depth conversation about the two characters, specifically Jess, who's the newer character. She was a little bit, I guess I hadn't really fixed her 100% in my mind at the time I sent the manuscript through. And we had a two-hour conversation about, you know, who is Jess? What's her background? Why does she do the things that she does? Why does she think that she can pin down this billionaire who doesn't talk to anyone? And I just went home and like rewrote all these parts and was so inspired.
Mm.
And I always think this stuff like that, you know, whether it's your editors or whether it's friends, writing friends and stuff, just when you have those absolutely like so engaging, enthralling conversations about people who don't exist and like why, you know, why does Jess do the things she does and what's Jess's motivations? And you're kind of thinking, well, Jess isn't real. But having this like, yeah, a two-hour conversation, you know, copious notes, throwing ideas out there. And it's just, it's one of the best parts of the process is engaging with people who are kind of, who get your book and want to help you make it better and help you kind of figure those things out. And so that was just, you know, because it could be, I guess, in a different context, a bit demoralising to have a meeting with two people who might be saying that, oh, one of the characters isn't quite up to scratch. But if you look at it from the angle of, we're all involved in making this novel better and making it really work for people, then it's really, really exciting.
There are a number of endeavours in life where you expose yourself to criticism or expose yourself to analysis of the whole 360 degrees.
Yeah.
But I imagine once you get through it and you get the confidence, as you said earlier, that you're actually writing for yourself and you think you've nailed this.
Yeah.
That must be a nice feeling.
Yeah, it's nice to think of it from, like, compare it to a first draft that would have had, you know, holes and gaps and bits that didn't make sense and timelines that crossed and, you know, bad writing and things like that. And when you look at this final version, I wouldn't like to say I'm amazing or anything. But I do kind of get this real pleasure of looking at it and going, oh, that looks like a book. That looks like a novel, you know. And for writers who are listening to this and readers as well, you probably have a sense of, yeah, that evolution from your first draft, your early ideas, your first iteration of something through to, oh, yeah, those, you know, those sentences feel really tight. That chapter feels like it's going somewhere. that ending is giving me, you know, satisfaction. All those kinds of things is a very, one of the high points is that moment where you kind of, or to me it has been anyway, where I look at, you know, the typeset copy or the final draft copy and go, oh yeah, that looks like a book that people would read.
Well, this that I'm holding, and our listeners will be able to see you holding it in the photograph.
Yeah.
Last Best Chance book, Donnell, is a book.
It is a book.
It's a book. It's an appropriate thickness. It's got lots of pages.
And it's got a fantastic cover, like we said.
And in between, it's just a great read. So
thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me again. It's great to talk to you.
It's always a pleasure talking to you.